This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. She calls herself a Canadian composer of Palestinian, Syrian, and Bosnian roots. Sawad Bushnak is among the very few Arab women recognized as composers on the world stage. She was born into a middle-class family in Amman, Jordan, and actually wrote her first piece of music when she was just 9 years old. It was a birthday song for her new baby brother. She pursued a music education that took her around the world. These days, she lives in North Carolina and writes more than birthday songs. In fact, she's composed a number of film scores and concert pieces. One of her compositions made its world premiere recently with the Syrian Expat Philharmonic Orchestra. On today's program, meet Sawad Bushnak. Just ahead on The State of Things. This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. The images of Syria filling the airwaves right now are those of war, violence, and destruction, but that is far from the Syria that my guest today knows and loves. Suad Bushnak is a Jordanian-born composer with Syrian, Palestinian, and Bosnian roots. She started writing music when she was just 9 years old, and as a teenager, she was transformed by the musical and cultural experiences that she had in Damascus, Syria. She is now one of a handful of Arab women composers in the world, and her compositions are featured in a range of documentary and feature films. One of her pieces also recently made its world premiere with the Syrian Expat Philharmonic Orchestra. And that's a German-based group of Syrian musicians who are trying to show the world a different side of their homeland. Suad recently moved from Montreal to Raleigh, where she teaches at the Triangle Math and Science Academy in Kerry, and she joins me now on The State of Things. Suad Bushnak, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. Take us back to those very early years in Amman, Jordan. What was your family like, and what were you doing growing up?
Well, I was born in 1982 to a family that was very culturally involved. I grew up in a home that was filled with books that were handed down from generations. They belonged to my grandfather, and then my father added more to them. We had music playing at home. We traveled a lot. We were enrolled in music classes, ballet, just basically involved in everything artistic, although both my parents were pharmacists, but they were artists at heart, so they encouraged us to follow these avenues.
Us, you were the oldest of five siblings, right? So tell us
Correct.
About that family life.
So for the first 9 years of my life, it was just me and my sister. We were pampered, you know. The traveling to Europe part, that happened when it was just the two of us. Uh-huh. But then three little kids showed up in the 90s, and I'm glad they did show up because they're the most amazing people I know. So my sister, who's a year younger than me, and I became sort of like their older siblings, but sometimes also, you know, we took care of them when my mom was at work or my dad was at work. So it was fun growing up with such, you know, diverse people.
You're apparently very happy when that first brother hit the scene. That was also your first song, right? Am I right?
True. When my brother was born in 1990, I think it was my dad he loves music, so he asked me if I can compose something for my brother. And I just composed this song. It was more of a, you know, the sort of song you would sing at school. You know,
sure.
It wasn't like some, you know, major artwork.
Didn't have five parts.
No. But it was a cool song. And my dad asked us to videotape it. And we still have the videotape until today on one of those massive VHSs. My sister and I sang it while I played it on the piano. And what's interesting is that that brother, Kamel, became a film music composer himself. So
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, now you were nine at the time and you write this song. Had you been dabbling at all? I mean, what was your interest in music at that point?
Well, I started piano lessons when I was about 5 years old. My aunt had a piano, my father's sister, and I would just, whenever we would visit her, I'd go and play. So my mom asked me if I'd be interested in taking piano lessons, and I said yes. So by the time I was nine, I had already learned how to play because I was taking lessons and going through the British board exams, which was a common thing in Jordan, having those, the Associated Board of the Royal Schools of Music examiners. They would come once a year to examine us. So I had learned my theory and all that. So that's how I was able to compose it, I would say.
Yep, you've got at least the bedrock or the foundation to make a song.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, you talked about having a lot of books around, the fact that your parents were very culturally involved. What culture? What kinds of things were you? Was it with Jordanian culture? Your parents are from two different countries. Talk about the cultural experience and the education you had in culture growing up in Amman.
So my father was an avid and still is an avid classical music listener. He had a huge library of vinyl records of classical music. And up until today, I remember one of my very faint memories from my childhood was being in the back seat of his car going back home after he had picked me up from nursery, from preschool, and listening to the Four Seasons, Vivaldi's Four Seasons. So this is the type of music I grew up listening to. My mother also loved music. She was more into the classical Middle Eastern music, such as Fairuz and Marcel Khalife, all of these names. So it was always, you know, good quality music that we were exposed to. But also we traveled to Greece every summer and we got to listen to a lot of Greek music. And just yesterday, while having dinner with my dad, he told me that he had lunch with Mikis Theodorakis, the famous Greek composer who composed the film score for Zorba the Greek.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just having dinner casually and he mentions that. I'm like, wow. Like, so it was just, I would say, in a city where, I mean, you're talking about 1980s in Amman, where only, not everyone took piano lessons. Music, or especially classical music, wasn't something very common. So when you sent your child to take a piano lesson, that was, first of all, expensive. Second of all, a lot of people thought, like, why are you wasting your time and money, you know? Mm. So to have parents who really encouraged that was rare at the time. It wasn't something that's, it wasn't like, oh, all kids take piano lessons.
Yeah, interesting. You know? And also, so music, obviously, a very important part of your upbringing and important to your parents. What about religion, your Islamic religion? How, were they conservative? Were they more, talk to us about that.
Actually, I grew up in a very, I wouldn't say secular in the sense that there was zero practice, but it was a very relaxed religious environment. I mean, my dad's side of the family weren't particularly practicing. So in my family, religion played a role just when it came to, we don't do wrong, you know, you don't hurt anyone, that kind of thing. It wasn't shoved down our throats in any way. No one ever asked me or told me that I should pray, for example, or fast. It wasn't something that's either of my parents told me to do. So in a way, I find that almost, it's funny to say this, but it's almost a blessing because I found my own way, where I found my own way without being preached to or, you know, brainwashed or anything. I just found my own way and it was a personal choice to.
What about the atmosphere in Amman in the 1980s? I mean, it's an Arabic capital, but it is also, it's a Jordan has a rich and abundant middle class. It's a big city. What was the atmosphere with regard to religion in Amman?
It's the same as it is now, I would say. It's not a country where women are forced to cover up or anything. I mean, there were swimming pools, mixed pools where, you know, people would go, women would be in bikinis. It was just like any other Arab city at the time, I would say. That was the case in all Arab cities. And when you're talking about countries like Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon, they're very different than the Gulf states. It's a different lifestyle, different people. There's zero connection with regards to culture and traditions. So it was an open society in that sense.
And music, we talked about that first song when you were 9 years old. Did you begin to then take, what about your career as a composer? When did you start seriously composing music?
So that song wasn't a landmark in any sense of the word, because just a year after that, I wanted to quit piano lessons. Hmm. And my mom was like, you quit piano, I break the piano. As simple as that. She liked to kind of give, you know, threats that are heavy like that. So thanks to her, I didn't quit my piano lessons. And it was when I hit 16 that I started realizing that I'm actually enjoying the music that I play. And although I'm not a big fan of interpretation, like I'd rather be composing my own music now and before than interpreting someone's work. But it was the fact that I was learning so much music that enriched my repertoire in terms of my, you know, the soundscapes that I was exposed to. And that led me to start coming up with my own soundscapes, you know. So it was basically what I learned, the pieces that I learned as a pianist, but also listening to music, all of it combined. I started getting these ideas that I wanted to try on the piano, and I started developing a voice, sort of to speak, a musical voice, which was making me come to the piano back and back again. Because it was like, you know, I mean, when you're 16, you're still a child. So I would be sitting at the piano and I'd be impressed by myself. Like, wow, did I just come up with that? Man, I need to write that down. And back then you didn't have the computer software to notate it. So, you know, you'd grab a sheet of paper, keep my fingers on the keyboard before I lose the chord and keep repeating, like, for example, G, C, E flat, you know, whatever, until I memorized what I played and write it down. So it was just like an exploration that led me to realize that I have this in me and I want to do it.
You talked about background in European classical music or listening to a lot of that. Was any of this new voice of yours also informed by Arabic and Arabic classical music?
Absolutely. I mean, I used to listen a lot to Marcel Khalife, who's a famous Lebanese composer, Omar Khayrat, who's a famous Egyptian composer who does this sort of orchestral Middle Eastern music. And that fascinated me because, you know, at the end of the day, I am Middle Eastern. And to have that Middle Eastern voice reflected so in such a classy way, that fascinated me.
We are talking today with Suad Bushnak, who also teaches at the Triangle Math and Science Academy in Raleigh. We're going to continue our conversation just ahead. But first, as we close out this segment, we will hear an excerpt of her music. This is called Prelude. You'll listen to that, and then please return to us on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest today, Suad Bushnak. She is a Jordanian-born composer of Syrian, Palestinian, and Bosnian roots who lives in Raleigh and teaches in Cary. Keep all that in mind as we continue our conversation. We were talking about growing up in Amman, Jordan. Then you continued your musical training in Damascus, Syria. Tell us what that was like.
So that was not the original plan. The original plan was to go to Canada, study at McGill, and I applied and I got accepted. And then we realized that it will not happen because international tuition fees are very high. So my mother told me that if we can't afford it, maybe you can go to Damascus or Cairo. And that was a huge downsize to my, you know, dream. But the thing is about Syria, I love it. But I used to feel that there was always this thing where people thought less of Syria. People in Amman thought less of Syria, you know. So when all my friends are going to England and the U.S. and I'm going to Syria, that wasn't something to, you know, broadcast at school. So I think I was first not willing to go, but then that same year, we visited Damascus with my mother. And also the Syrian Philharmonic Orchestra came to Amman for a concert. Mm-hmm. And I was impressed by what I heard and what I saw. So that kind of sealed the deal for me.
You did go there, and I guess you found that it was a little more open city, an open society, even than Amman, right?
Yes. I mean, there are way more religious sects in Syria than there are in Amman. In Amman, you're either Muslim or Christian. That's it. In Damascus and Syria in general, you would see, you know, there are Druze, there are Alawites, Shiites, even Jews, Muslims, Christians of all sects. So it was way more diverse, and no one asked you what your religion was. No one really cared. It wasn't something that anyone thought of.
You got a real shock, I guess, the first time you celebrated Ramadan and you walked in the cafeteria.
Yes, I mean, in Amman, if you eat on the streets in Ramadan back then, in the, you know, the year 2000, it wasn't something that you just do on the streets. But in Damascus, restaurants were open during Ramadan. I walked into the cafeteria on the first day of Ramadan, and everyone was eating. And I'm like, did I mix up the dates or something? And then I got used to it later that, you know, not everyone fasts, and they don't have to hide the fact that they're eating.
So say you just don't do it in public.
Exactly.
Perhaps we all sneak a snack,
yeah,
but
not
but,
in
but
public.
The idea that you saw. Well, that's interesting. Did that in any? What about the music too? I find it interesting too that to see these cultural prejudices, so that Jordanians sort of look down on Syria. And Syria has this rich and deep and long cultural history, and its contributions to all of our cultural development are many. It's just fascinating to me to hear these kinds of.
It's not to generalize. I mean, what I'm saying is I'm talking about private schools in Amman, uh-huh, where you're expected to go and study, you know, in a foreign country.
Yeah.
That's more like it. But I mean, every Jordanian knows that the best clothes you can get at the time were from Syria. You know, people would go shopping on a weekend and come back because of the quality of the materials. But for me, life there was more about discovering a part of Syria that I'm pretty sure no one outside of Syria would know, which is the cultural life. I mean, it was the year 2000, and there were jazz festivals happening in the old city of Damascus. They would give you a map that said that showed you which courtyard home had a jazz concert at what day. You know, so it was something that I've never seen in Amman. The orchestra was something for the Arab world. The Syrian Philharmonic Orchestra is something very important. It's not just any orchestra. I mean, they used to tour and do concerts, and they still do concerts up until today. Getting master classes from world-known musicians, they would come as visitors. And all of this for free, by the way. I did not pay a penny. It was an entrance exam. I remember going to my entrance exam, my nose, you know, just up the roof. You know, I'm from Jordan. I know what I'm doing. I had those British exams million times in my life. And I walk into this huge rehearsal hall, and there's a jury of like 40 people sitting on a long table. And behind them, there's an audience. So it's not, you know, it's not the stage fright of playing in a concert only, but also having, wow, a jury who's, you know, every person is trying to find a mistake.
<You're right. laughs>
So for me, it was like, whoa, what is that, you know? And that really humbled me. Moving to Syria was the most humbling experience for me as a musician. And I think every musician should be humbled, because if you think you're the best, you're going to produce music that's not the best. You know, you need to always be humbled. And I remember vomiting before my piano exams later on. We had two piano exams per year, and you had to prepare a half an hour program by heart. You can't have your notes with you, your music. And anyone can come to an exam and watch you. So it was open to the public, and with that same jury of the
same,
you know,
jury who's listening for the bad notes.
Yeah. So I remember, like, I would have panic attacks before it, but it's like, you know, it really honed my skills, yeah, and made me, I was practicing 10 hours a day back then.
So it focuses you as a student. It humbles you, which breaks you down and allows you to learn more. What about culturally, in terms of your voice, what were you learning musically there in Damascus, and how did your ideas about music change, if they did?
I was still learning classical piano because that was my main focus. But I also got introduced to Middle Eastern music theory and to Middle Eastern music harmony, not harmony, sorry, Middle Eastern music scales, the maqamat. So, and the quality of concerts that we attended also made me realize that you can't just get away with anything, you know. The Syrian musicians, even students, are very critical. I mean, you couldn't, even when I was composing there, I would have friends come and critique me or give opinions or whatnot. They're very opinionated people, and rightfully so. And when you're talking about Syria being a cultural hub, yes, I mean, Syria is an ancient civilization. When, if you are learning how to play the violin, it's not because it's something new that came to the country. Hey, look, you know, we're starting something called violin lessons. These are students whose parents learned how to play an instrument. It's been there for ages. I mean, Syrian cinema has been around since before the 50s, you know what I mean? So just being immersed in a place where people were down to earth, not caring about, you know, what brand names you're wearing, but more about what's in your head, that for me was fascinating.
Did it affect your style, your technique at all, or and the people you were able to collaborate with? Did that have much of an effect on you?
Well, I did start developing a musical voice in the sense that I really wanted my music to be different. And I had a friend who's a cellist, Suhaib Saman, and I'm still friends with him. He finally got Facebook after like 15 years. Well, seven of which Facebook existed, but he finally got it.
That's when I dropped my friends, but go
ahead.
Oh,
yeah.
Go ahead.
So he used to compose. He composes more in, he was influenced by Prokofiev and that school of thought, you know. But we used to play our compositions to each other and give each other opinions. And it was so refreshing to see someone who shares the same passion. And I had one of my professors who was my harmony and music theory professor, Mr. Viktor Babenko, who sadly passed away 2 years ago. He would come and listen to my works and give opinions. And the prelude that you just played, I played it for the first time in my life to him. He's the first person to ever hear it. So it just made me realize that there's so much you can do with music. Yeah. I also got exposed to the music of Aziza Mustafazadeh, who's an she's a jazz musician from Azerbaijan. Uh-huh. So she mixes the Middle Eastern maqam or scales with jazz.
Wow.
And that day when I discovered her music was a turning point in my life. I never knew you could blend jazz with Middle Eastern, and it's really influenced a lot of my compositions as well.
You talked about getting to Damascus in the year 2000. You were there in 2001 as well. What was it like on 9/11 and after?
I clearly remember the day 9/11 happened. I was going to visit my friend in her home, and my neighbors had the TV really loud, and I didn't know what was happening until I reached my friend's home, and I knew that, you know, the attacks happened. And I remember that day, it was gloomy, and I went for a walk with my friend, and I just thought, this is the end of the Arab world that I know, because I really thought a third world war would start. I think it's already started.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just a different style of war. But I do think we have been living in a third world war for quite a bit of time now.
So, and you had to leave Damascus, ironically, to go to Canada, where you wanted to go originally, but it didn't turn out the way you wanted again. Yet another plan dash.
Yes.
Tell us the story.
So after spending about 4 years in Damascus, we get this call that our Canadian visa has arrived. My family had applied for immigration 5 years prior to that. And I was happy at first when I got a call from my baby siblings saying, oh, we got the visa. And I was like, yeah, maybe we'll move next year, the year after. And all of a sudden my parents say, no, actually, we're moving in about a month. So you have to start packing up and we're going to move. So first I was in denial, like, yes, okay, we're moving to Canada. It's nice, all that. Until I took the bus that took me from Damascus to Amman, and my sister and I started bawling. Mm. I mean, it was like leaving a piece of my heart behind.
Well, and you were just about to finish up, right? I mean, you weren't even able to finish out the year, is that right?
Yes, I wasn't able to finish up, but it was something so important to us as a family to kind of just start this new life. And believe it or not, my mom always believed that something will happen to the Middle East at some point. And that's one of the main reasons why she wanted us to immigrate.
And you had to leave as a family. I mean, the point is there's no option. Once they say that, you've got to enter as a family. And so that's, you're on somebody else's calendar at that point.
Exactly. So the first year and a half that I spent in Canada, the first year and a half was awful. I mean, I was depressed. I missed Damascus. And of all places in Canada, we went to Kingston, which was my choice, by the way. So I feel guilty about that. But it was a very small city that was nothing like what I imagined the first world to be like. You know, like no skyscrapers. What is that?
Well, what was in Kingston that drew you there?
We arrived in the middle of January. Snow covered everything. Yeah. So I spent 3 months not knowing what there was.
But why did you choose it?
We went there because I had chosen to go to Queen's University, which again was, I mean, I enjoyed my year over there, but it wasn't McGill University.
And it wasn't Montreal.
It wasn't Montreal. It wasn't McGill University. Yeah. So I transferred later.
Well, so tell us about that and your experience at McGill.
That was a fascinating experience. I mean, the minute I stepped into Montreal, you know, it's a bustling city full of life, full of culture. And I was lucky enough to arrive at McGill the year they received a $20 million grant. The music building received that.
Wow.
So we had a state-of-the-art, you know, library with studios and all that. I also got the chance to be to take classes with some of Canada's most renowned composers. So it was an interesting experience also because McGill as a composing school is very avant-garde. So although I did get a scholarship to get in based on my compositions, which are not avant-garde at all, what I learned was on the other end of the spectrum. And sometimes it was difficult to try to go that way, but I'm happy that I studied something a bit different because it's kind of also shaped some of my future works. And it's kind of opened up my imagination to new soundscapes that I would have otherwise not been able to discover.
Can you integrate those two? I would almost think it might be easier to integrate Arabic scales with chromatic scales, you know, sort of Arabic and jazz, than it is to get your head around avant-garde styles over a more conventional style.
You're very right in the sense that if you know Middle Eastern music, these quarter tones and these things will come natural to you, will be natural to your ears, as opposed to someone who's only been exposed to Western classical music. So in that sense, yes. However, I've always had my idea of music was always that if non-musicians do not enjoy it, then I'm not going to compose it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I don't mean that it has to be naive music. You could still compose intelligent music that's complex, but that appeals to your wide audience, which is why people like Bach or Beethoven still exist till today, and which is why you would want to play a CD of their music in your car. So it was good to get exposed to that sort of thing, but I kept, you know, going in my own way, and I'm happy I did in a way because I didn't want to change my views of what music should bring to the world.
2 years into your schooling, you went home to find out that your mom was quite ill, and at least the news was quite sudden, whether or not she knew for more time. Tell us about that.
So I got a phone call from my dad saying that my mom wasn't feeling well. And when you get a phone call from your dad like that, my parents were never the type to be imposing. You know, they never asked me to come visit. So when I went to study in Montreal, I barely visited them. I mean, it was a 3-hour bus ride to Kingston, but I only went to visit during Christmas, you know. So when you get a phone call like that from your dad, you know it's serious. So I went and visited my mom and family twice after that phone call. And the first time she looked okay, but we knew that she probably had something wrong. And when I say something wrong, I'm talking about cancer, breast cancer. And the second time around, she looked even worse. She was like half her size. It was a day when I called home and no one answered. And then I had to call my brother's high school to ask him where my mom was. And he told me she was in the hospital. That day, I just walked out of McGill University campus straight to the bus station. And I took a bus to Kingston, and I discovered that she was in the hospital and that it was pretty much terminal. Yeah. And she passed away 10 days after that, actually.
You had a few memorable conversations with your mother.
Yes, the most memorable conversation is that when I called her, and she knew that it's the end. Mm-hmm. You know, that was before going to the hospital, and she told me, "I do not want you to be sad. Promise me that you will not be sad when I'm gone. I want you to be happy. I want you to, you know, take care of your father and your siblings, but do not be sad." And that's one of the main reasons why she never wanted us to kind of be worried about her. You know, she always came up at, we always had this impression of her as a woman of steel, you know, an iron woman, always vivacious, full of life, positive, laughing. You would never think she would get sick. So it was a shattering life experience.
And you had a suspicion that maybe she knew for a lot longer than she let on, right?
I have my suspicions about that. Yeah. And maybe just out of her love for her kids, she didn't want to shake. I mean, I had just started university. Like, I had finished my first year in university, but I had just started my second year. And she probably didn't want to shatter our lives by, mm-hmm. you know, making us concerned about her all the time. That's mothers for you. And
well, she also encouraged you to put together your first album, right?
Yes. And this is really, this CD had such a wild twist, because it was my first album. It's called Thoughts. And I recorded it because she insisted that my piano compositions, which have been sitting for years, need to be recorded. Mm-hmm. So I had a live recording arranged at McGill University. I played the piano, and it happened on her birthday, which was October 25th, 2006. And the idea was just for the CD to be, a demo CD that I give to family and friends. And shortly after that, she passed away. When my mom passed away, I became really spiritual. Seeing how fragile life is changed my entire, mentality. That's where when I started wearing the hijab also. And my concern as a musician, I still wanted to do music, but it was very difficult to compose while grieving. I mean, some musicians use grief to compose. For me, grieving meant service. I had to do something that's service related in order to grieve. So I brought the CD and I was like, I'm going to fundraise using this CD. So I started an online fundraiser on Facebook and raised around $2,000 for the Canadian Breast Cancer Foundation in her honor. And that kind of started opening my eyes up more with regards to how can I be a better human being that's not just self-centered and interested in my own music and my own life as a musician. How can I leave an impact so that when I die, I've done something that serves humanity?
I'm talking today with composer Sawad Bushnak. She also teaches at the Triangle Math and Science Academy in Kerry. We're going to continue our conversation just ahead, but first, we're going to hear some more music. We're going to hear a traditional Arab Andalusian tune, and I wonder if you can tell us, Sawad, what this one is.
So this is a recomposition of a famous traditional Arab Andalusian song called Lamma Badayat Athanna, which means when she begins to sway. And I worked it up in a new way, which is why I say recomposed. There's piano. You'll hear a bit of Baroque in the actual long piece. There's guitar, kanun, and a bunch of other influences that are combined.
We'll hear just a little bit right now and then be right back. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest, composer Suad Bushnak, born in Amman, Jordan, spent time in Damascus, Montreal, now lives in Raleigh and teaches at the Triangle Math and Science Academy in Cary. So tell us about graduating now. When you graduated from McGill, what happened next?
So when I graduated from McGill, I thought, you know what, I'm going to take some time to just do something different, because I was composing and happy about that, but I wanted to get involved in other things. So I started fundraising for Doctors Without Borders, and that got me interested in issues of social justice, which led me later to get a degree in education from McGill to become a teacher, because I wanted to kind of do something that's more, you know, real life related, in addition to composing, just to balance my life off. And I feel that teaching really grounds you as a person. It brings you back to earth. It reminds you that, you know, there are other things to do, not just your own world.
So as this personal, you're developing now a stronger sense of who you are going to be as a person on the ground, living on earth. You also are developing a deeper spirituality and a deeper connection to your religion. You talked about deciding to wear the hijab, which you had not done, and it was not anything that your parents had imposed on you. Talk about that decision and some of the experiences you had in Quebec and in Montreal as a woman of faith who is demonstrating her faith.
The thing with Montreal is that a lot of people saw me as a threat to women's rights, because in the 60s, Quebec separated church from state, and seeing me kind of reminded them of the days when the church wasn't, you know, in charge. So I would get comments, not very nice comments, from women, usually in between their, you know, between 40 and 50 years old or 60 years old, who were not happy to see me. And they would think that I was brainwashed or that someone forced me. And I mean, I never kind of explained to them, those people who would just insult me while walking, why I'm doing this, because I didn't, you know, if you're insulting someone, you don't want to hear anything but your own opinion. But it was, I mean, being different in a place, and we were talking about this before we started, some people expect you to represent, you know. Just because I wear a headscarf doesn't mean that I'm a spokesperson to every single Muslim in the world. I mean, a lot of Muslims I don't even want to associate myself with, you know. So it was a bit tough, but it didn't stop me from even teaching. I mean, I was getting teaching jobs in Montreal, and I was teaching in schools. So it was just that minority that's kind of tarnished it a bit.
Did you ever feel at some point like being a spokesman for those women who made it their choice to express themselves spiritually and to wear the hijab? In other words, you had an explanation for anyone who cared to hear it. Did you ever feel like making the case for that was something you wanted to do or should be doing?
I started doing it when I first started wearing it, just to express myself, you know, and you kind of get that fervor into you at first. But then I just quit. I'm like, you know what? I have bigger battles to fight. I have only a limited amount of energy, and I'm going to spend that on what I love. I'm not going to spend it on trying to convince anyone why I look a certain way, or why, you know, why because ISIS is doing something, then it means that I'm not related to them or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I'm saving my energy to what matters, and I'd rather just be me. And then if someone, you know, realizes, oh, you can be Muslim and wearing a headscarf and still compose, if someone wants to realize that, fine, but I'm not doing it for show. It's part of a dress code that I adhere to, and that's that.
Tell us about, too, your experience. I mean, all of these cultural, this deep and diverse cultural background that you have, If you feel connected to any of these, how apart from all of these cultures? Because I would imagine creatively, that's one of the things that can be liberating for an artist is to have experienced a deep cultural background without having been so identified with it.
Well, yes, I see an advantage to belonging to different places. I mean, on the one hand, it's not nice because in Syria, I was always considered Jordanian. In Jordan, I was always considered Syrian or Palestinian. And now I'm considered Arab, you know, in the U.S. or Canada, although I am Canadian by citizenship, too. So in a way, it's not nice. But on the other hand, it makes you take the best of each of these cultures, and it leaves, it leaves politics aside, and you just tend to also sometimes have a more objective view of what's happening without getting emotionally charged too much. But on the other hand, my music, I feel, is the only place where I can identify myself with a home. It encapsulates all of my hometowns, and that's where they are, and that's where I belong. So in a way, I carry my home in my music, which sometimes reflects a bit of Bosnian, sometimes reflects a bit of, you know, Palestinian or Syrian.
Well, tell us about your geographic hometown now, Raleigh, and moving to North Carolina. What was behind that decision, and what's the experience been like?
So I moved here because my husband got a postdoc position here at the NIEHS. So I didn't want to move here at first, but I'm glad I did because I love Raleigh. I love people in North Carolina. I mean, they're the friendliest people I've ever met. And it gave me time to start concentrating even more on my music. It's so peaceful and calm that I was getting even bigger ideas for what I want to write. And I managed to finish a good number of projects.
Well, let's talk about one of them now. You composed a piece for the film called The Curve, which has just officially been selected by the Dubai International Film Festival. I'd like to listen a bit first and then come back and talk about it. Let's listen. That's a short clip from the piece composed by Suad Bushnak for the film The Curve. And composer Suad Bushnak is with me in the studio today. Tell us about that film and your involvement in it.
So The Curve is Rifqi Assaf's first feature film. And that's why it's amazing that it got selected at the Dubai International Film Festival, which means that it's a very good film. I've been involved since the very beginning. I started composing when he showed me the synopsis, and then I composed to the script, and then I composed to picture. So it was a learning process, composition-wise. We have a film score that developed year by year. I've been working on it for 3 years. The film is a romantic psychological thriller, in a way. It has a lot of mystery in it. And one of the things I love about it is that it tells a very personal story about a person who's lost his father. The nice thing that I love about this film score is that it's, up until today, it's my most elaborate film score. It got recorded around the world. The strings were recorded live in Damascus. The oboe was by Dom Kelly, who's a famous British oboist. And it was just a beautiful collaborative effort.
Talk about the process. You said first you began composing on the treatment, then the script, then the visuals. Are you redrafting and throwing things out each time, or how much changed from the treatment to the visuals?
I have about an hour and 15 minutes worth of cues that we only use 10 minutes from.
Oh, wow.
So it was, I mean, I would not do that again with any other film, but this was a film that I was really willing to give it my all, and so was the filmmaker. And the filmmaker and I became friends, so he would even ask me about scenes, you know, like, do you think this scene is good? So I became also part of the artistic team that's deciding what the picture should look like.
You could say, I've written this really wonderful piece of music, and I wonder if you could find some visuals to go with it next time. It'd save you some time.
Maybe.
You can have him change his movie.
The thing about this film is that I came to realize how much the picture really revamps your entire idea of the film. I mean, you could, they say talking about music is like dancing about architecture, you know? And also talking about a film is similar. You need to see the film to realize what the filmmaker means when he asks or she asks about a specific style or a specific mood.
So tell us more. Now, you've done other compositions as well, concert pieces, and I'd like to know the story behind the Syrian Expat Philharmonic Orchestra. Maybe you should first tell us about them and then about the piece that they played.
So there's a Syrian musician who's a colleague of mine from Damascus. His name is Raed Jazbe. He's been living in Germany for a couple of years or a few years. And he came up with this idea that I want to bring all Syrian musicians who are living in Europe and create this big orchestra that's called the Syrian Expat Philharmonic Orchestra. Now, Syrian musicians have been around in Europe and they perform regularly, but his idea was to bring them all together. And his mandate was to show the world that, you know, this is the Syria we know. It's not what you see on the news. That is happening, but that's not the Syria that we grew up in and the Syria that gave us our education and our sense of, you know, music and arts. So he called me asking if I'd like to have one of my pieces performed because they would like to showcase Syrian and Arab composers. And I said, absolutely. I had just finished composing a suite for orchestra entitled Hakawati, which means the storyteller of Damascus. And I was like, this is perfect timing. So we chose a movement from Hakawati to be played.
Let's hear a little bit of that. That is the Syrian Expat Philharmonic Orchestra playing a movement from an orchestral suite composed by my guest today, Suad Bushnak. You wrote a piece called My Syrian Love Story that reflects your feelings about what's happening in Syria right now. Tell us about that and how are you, your feelings?
Tell you about the piece or my feelings?
Yeah, I mean about what's going on today in Syria.
It's unimaginable.
Yeah.
Never in a million years would I have thought that the Damascus, where I used to walk, you know, on my own at midnight without anyone touching me, never would I thought that this would become a war zone. And it breaks my heart into pieces. I mean, I kind of sometimes say I'm glad my mother didn't get to see this because she would have been shattered, you know.
Will you read from us from that piece called My Syrian Love Story?
Absolutely. Today, as I watch my beloved Syria drenched in the blood of violence, many thoughts come back to me, ailing my heart. I worry about its cinema, its theater, its music, its television, its writers, its painters, its industry, its churches, and its mosques, all of which the Arab world bows to. What I worry about the most is that mainstream media would do to it what it did to Iraq, Palestine, and Afghanistan, reduce an ancient civilization to a mere conflict zone with absolutely no recognition of its rich heritage and wealth of talent, intellect, and culture. I worry that foreign intervention would open the doors for transnational corporations, dragging it down the drains of globalization that want to transform every so-called third world country into an imperialist sweatshop. I worry, but I know that the determination of the Syrian people is unparalleled, that their love for their country is rooted in their souls, and that there is nothing third world-ish about Syria, and that those who think so ought to educate themselves. I also know that it took me a revolution to wake up and realize that I have never been more proud of my Syrian half. God bless you, cradle of civilizations.
That is composer Suad Bushnak reading a piece that she wrote called My Syrian Love Story. I wonder what you make of the refugee crisis and the response that we've heard most recently from American governors, including our own.
I mean, it's absolutely sad to label an entire, you know, population of people who are fleeing ISIS, to label them as terrorists is absolutely sad. And it's you know, not something that we like. But I also blame the Arab Gulf states who have the money, who have the ability to receive refugees, and they don't. I mean, they have the money to receive housemaids and you know, workers, but when it comes to Syrian refugees, they're closing their doors. So it's a very, it's a dilemma. I mean, on the one hand, maybe these refugees do not want to go to the Gulf states because they'd rather be in a better place. And on the other hand, it's so shameful that your own flesh and blood is not welcome in your, in your country, and you're just pushing them towards Europe and the U.S. So it's confusing. I'm sad that the word Syrian refugee exists. I mean, that is a phrase that I still struggle to deal with, you know, and to know that these people are, it could be you or me. I mean, there's nothing that could prevent me or you from being in that situation. These are people who did not choose to live in a war zone, and they're educated and they have families, and it's just so sad.
I want to thank you so much for taking this time with us. I want to leave time to play more of your music, Suad Bushnak, who is also a teacher at the Triangle Math and Science Academy in Kerry. Thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you for having me, Frank. It was a pleasure.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things, produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio. Once again, the music of Suad Bushnak.